the lumberyard and buy it? Do you just find it out in the woods, or do you go to the lumberyard and say, that looks like a nice piece? Or how do you go about?
And my boys, they find wood out in the woods, they bring it to me. Roll it down and reach it all, and rest foot and bring it in, like my mounds with, you know.
When you see a piece of wood, do you have an idea when you see that big piece of wood, what you want to do with it?
It don't take me long to see, you know, see whether it's valuable or not.
But do you see something in it, like, you know, say I bring you a piece of wood and you say that would be real good for a bird, or that would be real good for a decoy, or...
Yeah.
You don't say, gee, today I'm going to do a decoy, here's a piece of wood, I'll do it out of this. You look for the piece of wood that might be suited for that?
Yeah. You have to do that. Two pieces don't match by your piece don't look right anyway.
You're saying pieces mash. Are you putting pieces together then?
No. Like that bougie there. See that, I think it matches. So it's just, this one solid piece here, that's a chestnut. That's one solid piece. That there's not a lot of rhododendron, wild rhododendrons.
Does anybody in the audience have questions? I know we've got a few people here that have been...
Our other mystery guest.
Oh!
Mr. Pastor
Scott. Hi, we've not met. I'm Joan.
I'm Lester Price.
And you're from?
I'm from Mankton, and I'm the log maker.
Okay, that's what I figured. I had asked people before you got here, basically, what made them decide to work with wood, if perhaps there was somebody that influenced you, or if you just said, this is what I want to do, and perhaps when you started working with logs. A big question.
Well, the reason I started, the job made itself available, and they asked for a bidder, and I bid.
Had you ever done it before?
Oh, we'd done a little log work on custom housing, for, you know, whatever the people desire, but we never did anything along this nature, you know, really, King's Arch or dovetail type fabrication. When the job made itself available, we got involved, did our own research, and made our own jigs, made our own mistakes, and after 2 years, we began to learn a little something.
Did you grow up in a family where people worked with wood? Did people work with...
I've seen my dad make clapboards years ago when I was a tot, and I've seen him make a pole-type building with a King's Arch type cut. Yeah, I had a fundamental idea as to how the work was done. The research somewhat verified it, and we went from there.
What were you doing before you?
I never had a job. I've been a carpenter all my life.
Never had a job.
I've been watching you. Some of you may have seen the logs out here, and there's been a log building class. Maybe you could explain to us how you pick your logs for a building, and then how you go about notching it to basically run us through how you would build a building. What would you do?
Well, first, you're right, you would pick the log, and if you really wanted to do it, you know, the way the early American would do it, the frontiersmen, when they came into the states to set up residences, frontier homes, ranches, whatever, then you would go out and have groups of people, probably, because it takes a long time to broadaxe a log. And you broadaxe the log down to the size that you would want, which in most cases is a 6-inch log, but whatever diameter the tree happens to be. But in today's restoration or in today's work, you make the cut appear to be the same way, but you do an awful lot of cheating. You just cut your logs and take them to the sawmill and have them saw down 6 inches, and you're ready to go to work. If you want these timbers to have the appearance of broadaxe cut, you score them with an axe and edge them with a foot edge, which is much faster.
Maybe you could explain, maybe a lot of people here don't know what a broadaxe is and what these tools are and what defines the cut.
You don't have to have a broadaxe to score with. You can take use a regular timber axe. We all know what a timber axe is.
Does everybody know what scoring is? That's what I'm wondering. I mean,
all right, scoring is this notch. So scoring is a process that you use to make the log look like it was chopped. And the broad axe takes this wedge out, but it sometimes leaves the track of the axe, which indicates that the thing has been hewed. You don't hew a log with a timber axe. You just score it out and take the wedges out with a broad axe. And a broad axe could have a blade this long, or could have about a 10-inch blade. It'll have a crooked handle in it, and the handle in most cases would be temporarily installed so that it could be taken out and reverse the broad axe to make it a right-hand axe or a left-hand axe. And if you get tired working right hand and your back across the kidneys begin to hurt, you change your axe and go the other direction. That relaxes you some. And you sometimes don't have a choice. You may have to go with the grain. But you just score and broad axe and score and broad axe until you get the log down to make the log that you've already set, which in our case would be 6 inches.
Okay, so now
a broad axe is also flat on one side like a chisel, is it not?
Right, a broad axe is sharpened only on one side, and that keeps you in line with the straight edge of your timber as you cut it.
Okay, now you've notched your logs.
No,
not yet.
We've scored our logs. And we've broad axed your log,
right.
And we've made it, we've elongated it. You have two smooth sides, and you have bark maybe on the other two sides. Your log could be anything from 12 to 24 inches in diameter, you know, to begin with. So now you're ready to notch your log.
Okay.
And in our research, we learned that the early American used a jig sometimes, which doesn't work for us. And we, in our experience, learned to use a dimension. In this case, in our case, we used 2 inches. A two-inch arch would give you an appearance like near this, and you turn this upside down, and you have this reverse piece lacing this cut together. And as you go up this building, this ties itself together, and once the building's done, you could hook a bulldozer with a line around it and drag the building away, and it would just gradually fall apart. It wouldn't fall apart. You can't break it in two until it starts separating itself because it's laced up.
Do you put any nails in there, or you just trust?
You can if you want, but if you do it right, you don't have to. Yeah, and normally the timber is heavy enough to hold itself in place, so you use your next timber. And when you use your next timber, the previous timber is tied in. It won't go no place. It's laced up. You understand? If the log you put on an hour ago, and this log sits on top of it, you're laced up so that the log underneath is tied off. You don't have to worry at all about it. And if your timber is 12 or 14 feet long, normally your weight will take care of your alignment. And by the way, your alignment is all, if you want a good looking building, it's all done from the outside. If you're high, you probably use a string and a bolt for a plumb bob, or if you're on a one or two story structure, you can use a 4, 6, or 8 foot level and work all your dimensions from the extreme corner on all the outside corners, and your building will line itself up.
Are there many log buildings in this part of West Virginia that still stand that you've seen?
I don't believe so. I'm sure there's more than I know anything about, but in a restoration job that we had, we came from Marion County all the way up behind, what's the prison? What's the name of the prison?
Moundsville.
No, Huntsville. We came all the way up there to get buildings that, you know, that was donated, and there was a tax credit for them. We've taken buildings from Monongahela County, Wetzel County, Marshall County, and of course Marion County. And we've taken down some 67 buildings. Fort Salem restored their job, so I would imagine most of the buildings are gone. And the ones we didn't get, people were tarred up and burned.
Except I live in the southern part of the state, and I've run into a lot of log buildings that are just covered with siding, so you just have no idea
That's true. There are some good buildings covered up that we don't know.
You know, I used to live in a house, and it actually was probably the earliest standing house in Lewisburg, and nobody knew it because, you know, it had nice aluminum siding on the outside, and it was just, you know, beautiful log work inside.
Speaking of Lewisburg, those people and the resting on the pipe, you know, used up several of them. If you're from Lewisburg, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a big building, and it took lots of logs. It probably took 8 or 10 other buildings to do that job.
I used to live in North Carolina, and I'm real familiar with the log buildings down there, which...
Tobacco buildings?
Yeah. There were an awful lot of those. Did that tradition ever come up into this area?
I think it did southern part of the state, but I don't believe it's in this area. To my knowledge, there's no tobacco even raised here, and we don't raise
it. But I just wondered if, you know, that style of just building a building for an outbuilding would even have existed.
No. It was really out of the ordinary to have log structures in all the buildings that's necessary to run a dirt farm. I mean, normally it would be a reasonably decent house, and then whatever you could cobble up from there for your sheds. Sometimes you would have a good barn. But very seldom did you ever run across a situation where you had the house, the barn, the farm cellar, and all the buildings that are normally used around a little dirt farm.
Well, as I understand it, to a degree, when people first settled, they built the log buildings. But once the mills came in, once there was any way to make boards, you didn't make the log buildings, and you wanted to make more of a frame house. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you might be right. It began to phase itself out in the middle 1800s, 1835 to 1850. After 1850, there were some log houses, but I don't believe there were very many, according to our information.
Had you grown up seeing log houses and being in homes that were log and being aware that they were log?
Oh, yeah. I didn't grow up in a log house. I grew up in a Yankee siding house, which is, you know, not even as warm as a log house, but there were a lot of log houses in our area, you know, when I was a chap 5 or 6 years ago.
Did you ever see one being built when you were young? Or at that point, nobody was making
it? No. The only thing I ever seen built was the pole-type building my dad built.
What made you start?
Contract.
That redhead over there, she needed some money. I liked the challenge, and my chances were as good as anybody's. And I'd had some experience in beam structure and custom housing, so I gave it a try. And, you know, it got better as we learned more, and we wanted to see the end result. And the farther we got into it, the better we liked it, and so the longer we stayed.
So for you, partly the reason for doing it was a monetary.
Yeah.
But you also had that interest. I mean, it was like, this is a nice way to make a living.
Well, if you would, you would. You know, if you're a carpenter, you're interested in something to build, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do it with a saw. You can do it with a hatchet, or you can do it with an axe, or whatever it is that you want to build. We have a guitar maker, we have a chair maker, we have a toy maker,
and a carver.
They had their own inspirations. I don't know what started them. I didn't get here in time to find out. But if you got sawdust in your blood, you're going to stay with it somewhere.
Maybe it's because the first 9 years of my life, I could make a snowball off the log beside my bed. I was raised in a log house.
Where were the logs scored flat on each side to begin with? Why not just leave them alone?
I would imagine they couldn't handle them. Now, we've never been really able to find out. In the first log structures that came into this country came with the original pioneer, the small log. Now, that is a cabin, and the log house grew, you know, and they had more people. The settlement had more populace, and they had more people to do it. I'm told that that this may have happened along this order, that all the neighbors gathered in, and you would find a man here making a log, and a man here making a log, and 5 or 6 people making a log, and you might wind up with 2 or 3 logs a day. It really wasn't a speedy project. And you had to roll these things up on the building with some kind of a rolling system, whatever you could devise, whatever your, was available for you. Very probably it would have been a rope and a team oxen or a mule and a planking system, you know, poles that go up on your building. Some may have had poles on four sides and some may have changed the poles around. But
wouldn't it be easier to put up logs that, say, a 12-inch log that you could handle?
Oh, it'd be easier.
Then well, why heal them? I mean, the time was precious to people like that. They had a lot
time
to do to make a living. Why did they take the time to hew them?
They couldn't handle they didn't have the means to handle the weight.
Unless they'd use smaller trees.
Yeah. Unless they'd use smaller trees. That's what, and the smaller trees you have to cut more of them. So I really can't answer your question because I've never run across anything who explained it to me. But I do know that you could, if they would have a tree with, you know, a large diameter, that instead of hewing this tree down, they would split it, and they have two pieces to work on. And that cut the weight down, and it built faster. You look at a log house and you think it's a lot of logs, but really it's only eight rings. Normally it's only eight rings. You got big logs, you could do it with six. So if you have people who can set this thing up and you have people who can make the logs in 6 days, then you've got a 6-day project.
I would think, I've seen a couple real early log buildings where, I mean, you know, you're talking
right,
that big.
We've seen them in excess of 20
yeah,
inches.
Yeah, and it would seem to me you have no insulation. And in terms of keeping warm, you know, whether or not it's accurate, the bigger that log is, the warmer your building would be.
Well,
so I would think
6-7 inches of wood is plenty of insulation.
No.
Sure.
No, I've been in log cabins and I've frozen to death when the logs are this big. You know, at least to me.
Not if they're tight.
Well.
You've got to look at your floor, too.
That's why I was wondering whether or not you're making a log cabin where you're chinking, or this is tight notching.
No, we're chinking, and we've improved that. I mean, you know, you're right, because they didn't have a means to chink it, but, you know, we don't go to an awful lot of bother. We go to the lumber company and just buy some Corning insulation, you know, Owens Corning, and just stuff it in the voids and put a little concrete on each side of it,
right.
And you got about a 37 R factor, then I'll have to disagree with you.
Yeah, but, you know, on the old ones, then I
right.
would say that...
They did that with... They chinked that with the heartwood from the clapboards they made. They would make the clapboard, and then all these wedge-type pieces that they would have, they would jam in these cracks, and then they'd put mud out of the swamp or hair out of the horse's tail or the peelings off of a hog at butcher time, whatever they could put in these cracks, that's what they would do it with. And if this wasn't maintained every year, if it wasn't redone every year, this dries and goes out, see?
Yeah.
And that's why you're cold. And you know, it could be newspaper, it could be rags. We've taken them down, it's had stone in them. So what
there's,
are they
there's
crying?
A difference between chinking and daubing. The chinking is
yeah.
is pieces of wood, I've seen them laid in there.
Right.
And the daubing is the mud or whatever that covers that.
Right, right.
Did you say most of the old cabins you found that had smaller logs? I know of one over around Goshen, south of Buchanan, that my great-great-grandfather built over 120 years ago, still stands. This is a hunter's cabin now. He used anywhere from 12 to 18-inch logs. He hewed his down, which I can understand. Common sense is you're going to either, if you leave them round, you're going to have a lot of weight, like you said. They're also going to be wider and narrower.
Right, I may have misled you. The small log that I'm talking about would have been the Danny Boone type building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the man that came in here by himself and had to build him a place to get in out of the weather, which would have been maybe 8 or 10 feet square, and something he could kick up in 3 or 4 days.
Just
a kid. Yeah, yeah. Something like, you know, you see these skits on TV. But when people moved in with their families, they went to the hewn log. And the weight's the only thing that we know is why that there was in. And they chinked it the best way they knew how. Whatever they could stuff in the cracks, you know. Daubing, chinking, mud, horse hair, pelts, whatever.
Do some log structures have less space in between logs than others, depending on that joint you use? Like the dovetail joint?
The joint doesn't have a lot to do with it. The joint has something to do with who did the job. the holes can be made by your own desire. You can make a 4-inch hole, 6-inch hole, you can try to make them close together. Our experience is that if you don't have a pretty decent void, it's hard to chink or daub, especially if you use the chink, the wood, you know. Some places they want the wood to show, they want this heartwood to show, to make it look original. But if you try to use a 2-inch hole, you have to remember that you have a certain slope on the bottom and the top of your logs, and that's going to give you 3.5 or 4 inches of chinking. And normally, if you want to make any speed with this project, you chink one side of it or daub one side of it with, and we use Portland and concrete, a 1-2 mix, and we put it on over diamond grid plastiflath, and it's only, you know, like just thick enough till it appears to be solid concrete. And in a day or so, you put this Corning insulation in the void that is left and leave room to do the same thing on the other side. And you can't put too much insulation in because the insulation is do the same thing there as it does in your attic or in your wall. It'll settle so. So you don't have to worry about putting too much in. You may need to worry about putting enough in. And when you do this, when the job is finished, you only have 1 inch of concrete. So you don't lose your R factor with 1 inch of concrete with 4 or 4.5 inches of insulation between. And you got the 6 inches of insulation, or the R factor with your log, which gives you about a 37 if you got good Anderson or Pella doors and windows and you have them sealed up. I don't really know the statistics on it, but I would imagine you could save about 30% of your energy cost in this type of structure once you got it sealed up the way it should be. But I doubt seriously if you save any money in the construction.
I think to me the one thing that's come out in the whole talk this evening is that everybody grew up being around wood, around people that use tools on wood, and that each of you has your own special love of woodwork, and that that's a part of why you do what you're doing. And I think that's the real thing that ties everything together. And I just wonder, as a closing question, in terms of, like, I grew up where nobody did anything. You know, if something broke, you took it to somebody to get it fixed. I never saw anybody work with their hands, really.
Were they hiring?
And I'm just wondering if you feel that the traditions that you're doing, that you're meeting people that want to carry them on, and you think that's going to be something that continues on. Anybody can open that, I don't care. You know.
Well, in my case, everybody knows you have to have enough money to live on, but money's not all of it, by no means. The biggest satisfaction is when someone else shows interest in what I'm doing. I wouldn't probably be here if it wasn't for the satisfaction I get of seeing somebody make something out of wood that had never done it before in their life. There's a love for wood. If you're not careful, you find yourself talking about it as if it is a person in itself, such as wood don't like to be sanded, especially cross-grained. So it's a love for wood. It's like patting a cat backwards.
Anybody else have anything to say or ask or anything? I think it's been an enjoyable evening, and I've enjoyed hearing everybody talk about what they're doing, and I think it's given us all a sense of, I think you can find that joy in anything that you create. And for all of you, it's wood. I think for some of us here, it's a music or it's weaving or whatever it is, but I think, you know, what everybody's expressed is this creating is something that just makes you feel special. And that, you know, it's not the, you know, the making a living, it's not I'm not quite sure what I'm grasping for, but it's basically that the real important thing is the joy that you get out of what you're doing, and that's really a part of you, and that's an awful important part of who you are, and that's why you do it. And I think that that's something that makes everybody here a real special person that enjoys their life.
It's a contentment from within. I bet the older gentleman would agree. You're more contented when you're carving than anything else you could be doing.
Oh, yeah.
If you didn't, you wouldn't carve.
And I think that's a special part of Augusta. I think that maybe we all come here to learn, try to find that special thing that makes us all feel that way. And I'd like to thank everybody for being part of this, and I've enjoyed it.
I'd just like to say that we can read books, read the nature books, you know, on their environment. And I remember back when I just began to remember and realize what animals and birds were, you know. I seen birds then that you don't see anymore. And now they're on the... They're extinct now. Well, I think there are more people get interested in birds. A migratory bird, and I saw in the paper where they're the one that migrates to South America, you know. In the last 3 years, they've fell off, I forget how many percent. They see they're keeping tab on them in the United States and South America. Our hummingbirds, and our wild birds that migrate, you know. Now they're just becoming extinct. And I think people ought to think enough of them to have something to remember them by. Now I used to kill lots of birds. When I was a boy, I'd had an old 22 out in the woods. But you see, I didn't realize what I was doing. But now, when I was a boy, we had burned the new ground, you know, a plant of corn in. Wouldn't even use no fertilizer. We'd let the wood ashes do that. And we'd burn them brush heaps and log heaps in the spring of the year. And the whippoorwills would be so thick, they'd ride right down almost in the barn and sit there and holler. And you, me and my brother, we'd try to get, woke up there and try to throw a flat rock on them. See, now you can only hear a whippoorwill and it's kind of anywhere now. So that's something miserable. I think people ought to be interested. I think people just ought to grind to it, and every other man ought to learn to be a sculptor or something, and to put his attention on that extinct species and bring it back. Not in life, but in feature, you know, and in form. And that'll reach your wealth for generations, as long as the squirrel stands. If it just be preserved somewhere, you know, then our children and coming generations, you know, what have been here and what have left. Mm-hmm. I look at that all for serious.
Well, I think your work is a very good way to preserve it. Mm-hmm. If anybody wants to come up and take a look at these examples that we have here, I think it's something special to touch them and to feel them. I don't know how Wayne feels about you picking up his guitar, but everything else, you're welcome. You can't hurt the guitar. He's great. He keeps his Martins at home safe, but it's okay, you can't hurt his guitar. Whereas if I had the guitar, I'd be the opposite.
Something happens to that, and I can make me another.
Take it.